Hello, good afternoon. Sounds like you can hear me from the back. So today we're going to talk about inductance, both mutual inductance and self-inductance. So we just started talking about this last time I introduced this topic with the transformer demo, which is like one way of actually using mutual inductance between two coils. So I haven't done the summary that I usually do because we mostly talked about eddy currents last time, and so there wasn't very much in terms of like useful equations that you need to remember about that. Okay, so we're going to start directly talking about mutual inductance and self-inductance. So the idea is that if you have two coils in presence with each other, and you, for example, change the amount of current that you pass in one of them, it means that the magnetic field created by one of the two coils is going to change as a function of time. So if the other one is in the proximity of that first one, it's going to feel a change in magnetic flux through its coils. Okay? So that's the situation here when we're talking about mutual inductance. We actually study the interaction between two coils. One is considered as the source of magnetic field, and the other one is going to react to the change in magnetic flux through its coils. Okay? So this is the notation for mutual inductance, so it's capital M. You might find subscripts or not. So in the very beginning of the chapter, you do have subscripts, and then probably over time, we're going to drop the subscripts. One reason is that M21 is equal to 1M2, so it means that the problem is totally symmetric between coil 1 and coil 2. It's a physical parameter that only reflects the geometry between the two coils, so it means at what distance they are from each other, how big in radius they are, and how many turns they have. So it only has to do with the geometry between the two coils. It doesn't have to do with the currents. Okay, it's current independent. Okay, so M21 and M12 are equal to each other. This is what I've written here. And so if you don't see any subscripts, you can just use the capital M, okay, which is okay whether you're talking about effect of coil number 1 on coil number 2 or vice versa. Okay. So now the definition of M in terms of other quantities that we know is the following, okay? So in this case, it means that we're talking about a change in coil number 1, and we're trying to see how that affects coil number 2, okay? So that order means that it's due to coil number 1 and it affects number 2. So the effect is a change in the current that you pass through coil number 1, okay? This is the flux through one coil, one turn of coil number 2. So multiplying by the number of coils, so this is the total flux, okay? So the numerator of this fraction is the total magnetic flux through coil number 2 due to coil number 1, okay? So that's the definition of the mutual inductance. You have the definition of each of the parameters here. Okay, so as I said before, this is purely geometrical. There's no current dependence. We're actually going to calculate mutual inductance in a specific example. So you'll see that it depends on the surface area of the coil and the number of turns. The usual range for inductance is like from the micro Henry, so I haven't talked about the unit. This is capital H for Henry, from the name of the person who actually came up with this definition of mutual and self-inductance. So after describing the mutual inductance, we'll talk about self-inductance. So this is the usual range, okay? I don't know if you remember when we talked about capacitance, I also told you that a typical range is like microfarads to millifarads. It's very rare to have very high values, like on the order of 1 Henry. That that would be a really giant coil. So given the definition of mutual inductance, you can actually rewrite Faraday's law. Okay, so the situation you're facing is the following. You pass some current I1, which is going to be time dependent, through coil number one, and there's going to be a magnetic flux through the turns of coil number two. So you can write the EMF E2 that you build in coil number two as negative d phi dt, where phi is the total flux through the second coil. So the total flux is N2 times phi to 1, so this one being the flux through one coil. And then using the definition of M in terms of flux, you can rewrite the d phi dt like this. So we're using this definition here. And therefore, instead of writing Faraday's law in terms of a rate of change of magnetic flux, you can relate this to a rate of change of currents that you practically pass through coil number one. So this is a little bit more practical, because this is a quantity that you know you're passing in your coil. So it speaks more than a flux. Okay? So negative MD I1 dt is the rewrite of Faraday's law that reflects the response of coil number two to a change in the current that you pass through coil number one. Obviously, you can do the opposite thing and say, now if we change current I2 in coil number two, there's also going to be a change in the magnetic flux through coil number one. Okay? And so you would get the same type of expression, except that you have to switch the two subscripts. So I1 would become I2, and E2 would become E1. Okay? So this is the current passing through coil 2. And so this is the EMF built in coil number 1. Okay? So we can actually cover an example so that you can see how we can calculate the mutual inductance of, like, a real object. So we're going to use a solenoid as the source of magnetic field. The reason is that, you remember, the solenoid produces a magnetic field, which is nicely uniform inside the solenoid, so it's pretty easy to calculate. And the second coil is just going to be a normal, a regular coil, thin one, with a number of turns n, which would typically be less than the number of coils of the solenoid. So you can view the situation as something like this. Okay, so this is the solenoid. You pass some current I1 through the solenoid. You know that you have a magnetic field B1 created inside the solenoid, which is uniform. Which is mu naught. And I, where, so lowercase n is the density of turns, or number of turns per unit length. So we can rewrite this as mu naught n1 over L times I1. Okay, so I1 is the current that you're passing, and this is the ratio of the number of turns of that very long coil and L is the length. Okay, so N1 turns, right? And then you can imagine that around this, you have another coil. Okay, so it loops around the first one. This one has N2 turns. So we're going to calculate M using that that definition here, which means that we consider coil number 1 as the one that generates the field that changes over time. And we're going to calculate the change in magnetic flux through coil number 2. In theory, we could do the opposite, except that it's much more complicated to calculate the magnetic field created by this very thin coil. The magnetic field is not as easy to write as it is for a thin coil. So that's the reason why we do it this way and not the opposite, although in theory you would get the same thing. Okay? So this is B1. Now, what we need to calculate the flux here is the number of turns. So we have N2 turns in coil number 2. We have to calculate B dot A, so the projection of the magnetic field along the direction of the normal to the surface of the coil. So we're going to use the surface area of the coil. We need to check which surface area we're going to take into account. And we divide this by the current that you pass through coil number 1. So the definition is this one. N2 times phi, so the flux through one turn of coil number 2 is B1 times the surface area of what? So we're calculating the magnetic flux of B1, so the magnetic field created by coil number 1 through coil number 2. So what would you use for this surface area A that we're going to consider here? So which surface area is that? Okay, so 2. Okay, so that's obviously what everybody would say spontaneously. We're calculating the flux of the magnetic field B1 through coil number 2. Except that you don't have any magnetic fields outside the solenoid. So the idea is that your flux lines are confined inside the solenoid. And you remember that in the limit of an infinite solenoid, they never bend and close back on themselves on the outside. So the magnetic field B, ideally, is 0 outside the solenoid, which means that, how to show this. The surface area we're going to consider is only the surface area of coil number 1. Because even though coil number 2 is larger, okay, so you see that these coils are larger than the white ones, there's actually no field here. Let me try to use some colors. So here and here. Okay. So B1 equals 0 outside solenoid. So to be very clear, if you have to write something that's going to be understandable for a reader, it would be nice to add a subscript to show that you actually understand that the non-zero flux is only through the surface area of coil number one. Okay? Do you understand this point, or do you want more explanations? If coil 2 has a smaller surface area, then it means that it's entirely embedded in the larger coil, and so the entire surface area of coil number 2 would contribute to the magnetic flux in this case. Yes. So this is specific to this example because A2 is larger than A1. So you have the take-home message is that you have to take into account the surface area of coil number 2 that is in the presence of the magnetic field created by coil number 1. So if you're in an area where B1 equals 0, then this surface area is not going to contribute to the magnetic flux. Yes? It doesn't have to. I mean, you could be in a more complex situation where you pass a current through both at the same time, and then in coil number 2, you would affect the existing current by creating an induced current. So you would have to add the two currents. Here, to make it easy, you could consider that initially there's no current at all, and you're just going to generate a current by passing a current I1 in the first coil. Okay, so you don't have to. It can happen, but you don't have to. All right? So you can take the whole surface area, A2, into account if A2 is smaller than A1. Okay, so we're here. I'm going to go back to the other board. So now we can rewrite this mutual inductance by replacing the magnetic field B by the expression that we've just recalculated earlier. Okay, so we're going to have N2 times the surface area A1 of, so the smallest of the two, times B1, so B1 is this ratio, and the whole thing is going to be divided by I1. So this is mu naught N1 I1 over L. So you see that the current disappears from this expression, and we finally get mu naught times the product of the two number of turns times the surface area. A1 in this case, you would have A surface area in general, divided by the length of the coil number 1 that produces the field. Okay, so that's a typical expression for a mutual inductance. So you see that it's totally independent of the current that you pass in coil number 1. It only depends on like geometrical factors, okay? The dimensions of the coil, the surface area, the length, and the respective number of coils of number of turns of each of the two coils.
So should we expect that usually the coil always gets a lot?
Yes. Yes.
Even though it's in the definition, it should cancel out.
Exactly. Yes. So it is in the definition, but the thing is that the flux also depends on I. And so you have a cancellation. So if you have to calculate either a mutual inductance or a self-inductance, you should always find something that looks like this, which is totally independent of either of the two currents. Okay? So it should depend on mu naughts, then a product of two number of coils, a surface area, and divided by the length, typically of the one that produces the field. Okay? So this is always what you should expect. And we'll see that for self-inductance, this is also very similar, except that instead of having two different coils, it's the same one that produces the field and feels the change in magnetic induction. So it's going to be an N squared instead of N1, N2. But it's going to be the same type of expression here. Okay? Are you okay with that? So a very typical example of practical use of mutual inductance is the transformer. Okay, so you remember we did a demo last time. I have another one here where we can actually do something. I can show you that you can take advantage of the transformer to do something very practical. So this is for spot welding. So very briefly, I'm going to go over the transformer so that you can understand how we use this effect of having a change in current on one side that produces an EMF on the other side. So the idea is that if you want something that's going to be long-term effect, you need to have a constant change, a long-term change in the currents. So that works with AC current, typically. Okay, so you have to run AC current through the transformer on the primary circuit. So what I'm drawing here is this metallic frame, which is usually made out of iron. Okay, so you see that rectangular frame here is an iron core. I don't know if you can see from where you are, but if you come closer in the end, you can actually see that it's laminated. So instead of being just one block of iron, you have some foils of iron that are insulated from each other. And this is to prevent eddy currents. So you remember the types of currents that we talked about last time that can produce very strong effects and a lot of Joule dissipation. So in order to prevent this from happening in transformers, you actually make some sheets of metal, you insulate them, and you stack them. So that reduces eddy currents. So that's the frame, and the purpose of this is to constrain the field line to go from the primary's on that side here, from the primary circuit to the secondary circuit without too many losses. So it's a flux guide. The idea of this is a flux guide. So you have a primary circuit with N1 turns. You pass some current I1 in the primary circuit. So this is plugged on the wall, so it's AC current. And by electromagnetic induction, you're going to get some currents I2 on the secondary circuit that you can use to do something. Okay. So you all use transformers all the time. You know, every type of appliance you're using is based on a transformer because you need to change the 120 AC volts that you get from the wall into something that's smaller. Okay, so typically the objects that we use in everyday life, the voltage ranges between 6 volts to 15, 18 volts, depending on the applications. But so we use a lot of step-down transformers. There are also some step-up transformers sometimes. So typically, at the stage after the production of electricity, when you want to transmit electricity in high voltage lines, you use a step up transformer. The reason why this is done is that it limits the losses. It's more advantageous to carry electricity in the form of high voltage instead of low voltage. But most of the time, we use step-down transformer. And so I'm going to show you that the ratio between the number of turns on these two coils determines the ratio between the two voltages. So the one that you input and the one that you get on the secondary. So you see that here we have 5 turns, which is a lot less than 250. Okay? So that's the reduction factor between the two voltages. So you have a certain number of turns, N1, on the primary circuit. This is an AC generator. Okay, so typically we're using 120 volts AC. So we have some current I1 flowing here. I'm just going to pick one arbitrary orientation, although since it's AC, it's going to go back and forth between the two. Okay, so this is not very meaningful. And the idea is that on that side, you're going to get another voltage and currents based on the ratio between these two numbers of coils. Okay? So the assumptions we have to make to get something which is really, really easy to use is that the flux line are confined here in the iron core. So we're assuming that the flux through each of the turns is the same on both sides. So it means that you don't have, even when you go over the edges of these rectangles, you don't have any loss in magnetic field lines. So they all go through, they all follow the flux guide until they reach the other side. And so the density of field lines per surface area is the same on both sides. So this is one assumption for an ideal transformer, that there's no loss in magnetic flux. The other assumption is that you don't have any resistance on either side, which means that you conserve electrical power. And so if you use these two assumptions, then you can end up with something which is relatively simple. So let me summarize this. So assumptions for ideal transformers. So that's one, and the next is so assuming you have no electrical resistance in series with whatever appliance you have, it means that you have power conservation. And so the product's IV is conserved. So if we get back to the definition of the mutual inductance in terms of magnetic flux, on the one hand, you can write this. If you consider that a change in current through coil number one is going to generate a magnetic flux, N2 times phi, this being the flux through one turn. If you actually write this the other way, like using the symmetry of the two coils, you can write that this is actually N1 times flux through one turn of coil number one divided by I2. Okay, so let's say once you've generated some current I2 at the secondary, then this change in I2, if you have AC currents in the primary circuit, you're also going to generate an AC current at the secondary. Okay, so there's also a change in I2. So di2 dt being non-zero means that you're going to create an EMF on the primary circuit. So that's why you can reverse this. And you can write M in two different ways. And because of our first assumption, which is that we have a perfect flux guide through the RN core, that phi here is the same on both sides. And therefore, you see that the ratio of number of turns N2 over N1 is the inverse ratio in terms of current. So this is the relationship between the two currents, I1 and I2. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Thank you. Now, if you use the second assumption, which is that you conserve the electrical power by neglecting all the possible losses on either side, you're going to write that V2 I2 equals V1 I1, and therefore V2 over V1 equals I1 over I2. And therefore, so you can write another equality next to this one. So the one that we use most of the time, and which is actually the easiest to remember, is the ratio of the two voltages compared to the ratio of the two number of turns, because they have the same order for the two subscripts. Okay, so you can use the same reduction or increase in the voltage based on the number of turns. And then, I mean, this one you don't even really have to memorize anything. You can find it so quickly that it's not worth really remembering this. Okay? So let's have a look at this now that we've described a little bit how it works. Last time I just showed you with the galvanometer, there was a multimeter plugged on the secondary measuring the amount of voltage that you get on the secondary. So I showed you that by varying the number of coils, N2, on the secondary circuit, then you change the end voltage that you get, okay, because you change N2. So here we have a fixed number of turns, so the ratio is what it is, which is like 5 over 250. Okay? And so we can turn on the AC power. Okay? So I'm energizing the primary circuit here. And on that side, we have a device, which is a spot welder. So we have two nails, and there's a handle on that side. So you can put them close to each other. And I don't know if you can actually see her. It was probably more visible on my side. It becomes very bright red, okay? So it actually melted, okay? So you can spot weld using this, okay? It melts the metal. So it means that there's really a huge amount of power that you can get. It's enough to melt steel. These are steel nails, okay? So you can do all sorts of things using this, okay? You can also melt some metals and use levitation to create some alloys without touching anything, which can be very useful for certain applications if you want to avoid contaminations from the bath, for example. So there are all sorts of very very tricky devices that you can use using electromagnetic inductions. So you can come here later if you want to convince yourself that this is actually really, you see, it's touching, okay? So it's really welded. So yeah, transformer is really a major application of mutual inductance, okay? It's probably the example. If you need to remember one, this is the one to remember, okay? So the basic idea is that you have a change in current in one of the two coils. It produces a change in magnetic flux through the second one, okay? And since you're using AC power, it means that the secondary also has AC power, and therefore I2 produces a change, and so you also have a change in the first one. So it's really a self-consistent type of demo. Do you have any question about this? Inductance, mutual inductance, the transformer. Yes. So this is one very typical situation where you have two coils close to each other with a flux guide that constrains the field line to go from one coil to the other. And so any effect of change in electrical currents that passes through one of them is going to be sensed by the second one, because all the field lines goes, they're guided through the second one because of this iron flux guide. Okay? That makes sense? Do you have other questions about the transformer? Okay. So now that we've talked about mutual inductance, we're going to talk about self-inductance. So the reason why we started with mutual inductance is that it's probably conceptually a little bit easier to think of this effect when you have two distinct objects in proximity. So you have coil one and coil two, and each of them acts on the other one. Well, now the thing is, if you pass some current in coil one, the coil is there and it offers some surface area. And so there's going to be a flux of magnetic field through its own turns. And so there is something which is very similar to mutual inductance, except that it happens even if you only have one coil instead of two. So that happens when you have a change in flux. So usually it's current driven. So you pass a changing current, so typically an AC current. So the definition is going to be on the same format as it was for M. So you remember we had N2 phi over I1. So now we don't even have to use some subscripts because it's irrelevant. So N is the number of turns of that single coil. Phi is the flux through one of its turns. And I is the current that you pass through the coil. So every coil has a self-inductance. And you see that it increases linearly with the number of turns. So to get a little bit more towards circuits, what we define as an inductor is a long coil, typically. So something that has a lot of turns. So that defines an inductor. So an inductor is something that produces a high self-inductance, could be the definition. The symbol is this. Okay. With usually like L for the self-inductance, which is noted right next to the symbol. So we can do the same type of problem as we did with the solenoid and coil, except that this time we're just going to have the solenoid itself and nothing else. So one more time, we can write the magnetic field inside the solenoid as mu naught times the number of turns per unit length times the current that you pass through the solenoid. And then you can calculate the self-inductance of the solenoid as N times the flux. So the flux is going to be BA through one coil, A being the surface area defined by one coil, so typically this. Okay. Divided by the current that you pass through. Okay, and then by substitution, you're going to have NA over I times this, mu naught NI over L. You see that once again, the current disappears. So this is how it should be. Make sure that the mutual inductance or self-inductance never depend on the currents, although the initial definition shows electrical current here. The thing is that the current is already embedded in the magnetic flux, so they should cancel out. And you have something which is purely geometrical, depending on the surface area of the coil and the length of the coil. Mu naught N square A over L. So you see that the only difference between what we obtained earlier when you had the solenoid plus that very thin coil is that you have N squared instead of the product of N1 by N2. Okay? Otherwise, the meaning is the same. It's just the way the coil reacts to a change in magnetic flux that it produces itself because of the change in current that you pass through that single coil. Okay. So it does not depend on current. Okay. Do you have any question about this? So there's one example I suggest that you go over as an optional homework problem. It's a coaxial cable. It's in your textbook. Let me find the right page. Example 35. This is page 789. So you'll see that it's a little bit intriguing because you don't have a very well-defined closed loop, or you might not see that right away, because when you have a coaxial cable, you actually have, so you have an inner wire, like a cylindrical wire, and then you have an insulator, and then you have a mesh of another conductor on the outside that passes a current which is the same in magnitude but in opposite direction. So this is an insulator, and then you have like another layer of conductor here. So this is I. You have another current I flowing like this. Okay. So, well, first thing you're going to have to do is calculate the magnetic field created in like different regions of that system. Then you're going to have to define the magnetic flux through a surface area, which you're going to define as rectangles here of a certain length L. So you're going to calculate something which is going to be based on a cut that you make in this coaxial cable. And the closed loop, which is not necessarily very obvious to detect at first sight, is actually this. So it's a device where you have one single turn, but it closes at infinity on either side. So this is how you close the loop. So you imagine that where you plug your coaxial cable on each end of the cable, this is what is going to close the loop on these two ends. Okay? So this is a less straightforward example where, so you have one term where the loop actually closes only like close to infinity, which is not even, you know, apparent when you make the drawing. Okay? So don't be disturbed by this too much. Try to be very systematic. Follow the guidelines in the textbook. They're going to help you define like very thin rectangles through which you can define the magnetic flux, and then you're going to be guided towards the end. Okay? So I think that would be very, very helpful. Now, so let's see. We've talked about mutual inductance and self-inductance. So now I'd like to talk about energy storage. You remember for capacitors, we calculated the amount of electrical energy that you can store in a capacitor that has capacitance C if you apply a certain voltage V across the two plates. So we can do something very similar here. If you pass some current I through an inductor, the cost in energy for the battery, for example, so the amount of electrical power that you need to supply to pass some current to go from zero to I, let's say, in the circuit. So the reason why I'm saying we're going from zero to I is that by nature, the inductor wants to resist the existence of a current because it builds up an EMF. And therefore, it creates an induced current which opposes the change in electrical current. So if you're closing a switch, so you're going towards an increase in electrical current, the built-up EMF, and therefore the induced current in the coil, is going to resist that. So you're not going to have like a sharp change in current from zero to maximum I naught. You're going to have something which is very rounded due to the electromagnetic induction that resists the existence of a current passing through the coil. So we can calculate the amount of energy that it costs to go from zero to I, the maximum current that you want to pass through the inductor. Okay. So let's talk about energy storage. So the power that you need to supply to the inductor to establish a current I is the product of, so the absolute value of the EMF, okay? We don't care about the negative sign. We're reasoning in terms of rate of change in energy that basically the battery needs to supply for the inductor to accept a certain current I in the circuit, okay? So that's going to be written, if you remember the very beginning, so maybe I haven't written it here. For self-inductance, you can also rewrite Faraday's law the same way we did with mutual inductance, except that in this case, we only have one coil. So again, we don't need the subscript. Okay, so this is the EMF that you build up in the coil. This is the self-inductance, and this is the rate of change of the current through the inductor. So if you're reasoning in terms of absolute value of this voltage, we have an L di dt. So we're going to have L I di dt. Okay. And the energy supplied to increase the current from zero to some non-zero value I. So this is how much you need to apply to counter the effect of the induced EMF. So this energy is basically the integral of PDT. So PDT is going to be this. And you integrate this between 0 and I, which is going to be the maximum amount of current you can pass through the circuit. So you end up with 1/2 L I squared. Okay, and so the idea is that this is the energy that can be stored in the inductor. Okay, so this is the amount of energy that you need to supply to oppose the induced EMF. This is also the amount of energy that you can store. And using the same procedure as we use for the density of energy that you can store in a capacitor, we're going to do something similar with magnetic field. Using a solenoid, so you've probably got the feeling already that The solenoid is going to be for magnetism what the parallel plate capacitor was in electricity. It's like the, you know, the usual type of device, the ideal type of device where you consider that all the field lines are parallel to each other, the field is uniform in a very well-defined area, which is the volume either between the two plates or inside the volume of the solenoid. Okay? So in this case, we're going to calculate the energy density based on the solenoid, but that's going to be valid actually for any type of configuration. It's just the easiest way of calculating the energy density. But again, that's going to be something which is much more general than just the specific configuration that we're going to use for doing this proof. Okay, so we calculated that the energy, so now I'm switching from W to U, where this is the potential energy that can be stored by the inductor instead of being the amount of energy that you need to supply with the battery, but both are equal to each other in magnitude. 1/2 L I squared. Okay, so that's by the definition that we've just obtained, the amount of energy that you can store. Now, if we're studying the specific case of the solenoid, we already have an expression for L, which is here. So we're going to reuse this. 1/2 of, let's see, mu naught N square A over L times I squared. What we're going to do is artificially introduce the magnetic field B. Okay? Eventually, if you remember what we got for the amount of, so the density of energy that you can store in an electric field that was proportional to E squared. So we can make an analogy here, and we're going to get something that's proportional to B squared. So I'm going to artificially isolate something which is B, okay? You remember that the B for the solenoid is here. So we need to make this appear in this expression, and the rest is going to be the prefactor. Okay? All right, so let's see. We're going to have 1/2. Mu naught and I over L squared. So let's see how we need to modify this to get back to this expression. You see that we need to divide by mu naught so that we have the same power. We have an N square. Then we have A. We have 1 over L here. We have 1 over L squared. So we're going to have to multiply by AL, and the rest is fine. So what appears here is B squared over 2 mu naught times the volume defined by the solenoid of length L that has surface area A. Okay, so for a solenoid of length L that has a cross-section surface area A, then the inner volume of the solenoid is AL, that I wrote V here, and therefore you can get this as the energy density. So this is the energy per unit volume. So it's usually written with a lowercase u, just like we did with the capacitor. So if you want to make an analogy, with the electric fields, we had obtained epsilon naught over 2 E squared. Okay. So remember that we still have the same factor 1/2, and we still have the variation as the square of the magnitude of the fields, whether it's electric field or magnetic fields. It varies in a very similar manner. So you can actually, in many different situations, you can do the same thing here, actually. If you remember, the energy that you can store in a capacitor of capacitance C is 1/2 CV squared. So you can replace, you know, C by the inductance L, and you can replace the voltage by the current, and you have something that's very symmetric between electricity and magnetism. Okay, so if it helps, you can really go from one to the other pretty easily. So this is also to tell you, so let me make a note here. This is actually much more general than just the case of the solenoid that we've used to demonstrate this. This is actually true all the time. Wherever you have a magnetic field in space, the energy density is defined like this. Okay, so we've done the proof in this situation because it's a lot easier, but you can make it much more general than that. So this is valid. For any B field. Not just the solenoid. And the last thing I wanted to mention about this is that in the same way as we said that the energy was stored actually in the electric field. So if every time you have an electric field, it means that you're able to store energy. This is what electromagnetic waves do. The same thing happens here with a magnetic field. So wherever you have a magnetic field in space, energy can be stored in the magnetic field with this form. Okay? So when we said earlier the energy is stored in the inductor, you can be a little bit more precise and say that it's actually stored in the magnetic field created by the solenoid. So now let's have a look at this demo. Otherwise, we're going to run out of time. So we have here a ramp with 5 light bulbs. This is connected, well, it's a little bit entangled, but so this is connected in series with a coil. And it's open in the middle, and you can introduce or not an iron core in the middle. Okay? And so we're going to do the demo using DC currents and AC currents, and you're going to see what the difference is in either case. And maybe that's going to support your understanding of electromagnetic induction, and you're going to see how a change in magnetic flux can have like some real application in a real device. So this is DC current. Okay, so you pass the current, you have like a lot of brightness. You'll compare with what you get afterwards. And if I introduce the iron core in the coil, nothing is going on, and I can take it out and go back, and you see that nothing is happening, okay? Now, when I switch to AC, okay, you see that first it's a little bit dimmer already from the very beginning. And then you see that there's no more light at all. And obviously it comes back when I remove the iron core. Okay? So there is a very fundamental difference between these two options that I have to pass some current. See that if I pass some DC currents, I have something which is static as a function of time. So whether or not I introduce this iron core, which is going to increase the magnetic flux through the coil, because the coil, by creating a magnetic field, are going to make this ferromagnetic. So that's really going to enhance by a lot the ferromagnetic response and therefore the magnetic flux through the turns of this coil. The thing is that because the current is static as a function of time, there's no change in magnetic flux. And so there's no EMF. So you don't observe anything. Okay? Nothing is going on because d phi dt equals zero. Okay? So there's no electromagnetic induction in this case because it's a DC current. Now if you use AC currents, you see that you already have an effect right now. The lights are dimmer than they were initially in DC, and the reason is that there's already some EMF that's built due to these coils. Now, if you want to enhance the effect even more, you need to increase the change in flux. And so you can increase the change in flux by either changing the rate at which you apply the change, but that means changing the frequency, which is not like easily doable with what we have here. Okay, so if you go from like 60 hertz to 120 hertz, you would be able to do that. Okay, and you could observe something that would be significant. Working at constant frequency means that you need to find another option to increase the change in magnetic flux. Another option is to change the magnitude of B. So by introducing inside the coil something that's going to increase the B field by a lot, very significantly, then you can also increase d phi dt. Okay? So you're changing the rate of change of the magnetic flux enough so that you impede the flow of the current so much that there's not enough current available for the light bulbs to be bright. So you don't see anything. The current is not enough for the light bulbs to light up. Okay? And so this is constant. The reason why you don't see any change at all is that, so it keeps changing all the time. This is an oscillatory current, so it goes back and forth all the time, 60 hertz, between positive and negative values. So it's not like only when you introduce the core or when you remove it. The effect is visible permanently because you have an AC current, and so you keep building this EMF all the time. It switches direction depending on the direction of the AC current that you pass in the coil. So it's always going to be opposing the direction of the actual current, but you're going to see a stable effect over time.
Is that what the DC was? Like when you put it in for like almost an instant, it looked like it got a bit dimmer?
Yeah. So you can do that. You can do that in DC, but you're going to see something which is really instantaneous. So exactly So it depends if you want to dim or if you want to do the opposite and get something really bright. But you can like see a flash for an instant, very brief instant, if you use DC current. Do you have any question about this? Okay. So let's continue. So we're going to start talking about LR circuits. Okay. So this is actually something very similar to what we have here. So the light bulbs are resistors, basically, and you have a coil in the circuit. So what we're going to do is, so with the same format that we use for RC circuits, we're going to put in series in a circuit a resistor and an inductor and a battery initially. So you're going to start passing some current from zero to some maximum value. We'll see how it varies. And then suddenly you switch to eliminate the battery from the circuit. And then you're going to be able to observe the decay of the current as a function of time. Okay? So again, this is very similar to what we observed in RC circuits. So there are many things that you can deduce from the study that we did earlier with capacitors. So we're going to use DC current in this case. So there's going to be no oscillatory behavior. So it's called a transient phenomenon. It's going to happen very briefly. At the time scale of the relaxation time of the circuit, which depends on both the inductance and the resistance. Remember the RC, the product RC, which is called the time constant for the RC circuit. So we have something very similar, except that this time it's going to be L over R, CY. And that tells you basically how fast the phenomenon is going to occur. So you have a resistor R in series with an inductor L. And you have either nothing, an ideal wire, or a battery. Okay, and so you can flip the switch from this position here where you include the battery in the circuit. This is going to be inactive because it's an open circuit. And then when you flip here, then you're going to remove the battery, and the current is going to flow only through that top loop. Okay? So this one has inductance L. So the initial situation is let's call the bottom position 1. Okay, so let's call this 1, and this is going to be 2. So we're going to use one of Kirchhoff's rules. Okay, so by adding the different electric potential drops across the circuit, we know that the sum of all the voltages needs to be 0 in a closed loop. And so we're going to have, let's call this V0, okay? The battery that's the voltage delivered by the battery. So let's make some points so that it's easier to figure out where we are. So using this specific position of positive and negative terminal, you know that the current is going to pass in the circuit in this direction clockwise. So it's going to come here like this. Okay. So using this direction for the currents, we have VA minus VB, which is plus RI, according to Ohm's law. Then, so let's see what's going to happen through this inductor. So to figure out what's going on with the EMF, the easiest is probably to remember every time that the EMF is built up in such a way that the induced current wants to oppose the change in the, let's see, the initial current. So what you're doing when you close the switch to the battery, you're slowly increasing the current from zero to a maximum value that we'll see what it is, okay? So as the current increases through the circuit, at the same time, you increase the magnetic field created by this coil, and therefore you increase the magnetic flux. And so you're going to create an EMF that opposes this increase in magnetic flux and this increase in currents. So what is the situation that enables to reflect the fact that the built-in EMF that appears in this coil would force the induced current to flow in the opposite direction? That's the idea. What? Who said something? No? Okay, I thought I heard something. The situation is the following, okay? As the currents, so the current that you deliberately pass through the currents, because you have this battery acting to like slowly increase the current from zero to I, produces an EMF in such a way that the induced currents will try to pass in the opposite direction to oppose the increase in this current capital I. Do you see that or not? Does that make sense? Yes? So the reason why I'm talking about this is that when we want to use Kirchhoff's rule, you need to be able to figure out in a very systematic manner, so that needs to become automatic. You need to know what side is going to be a higher voltage or a higher electric potential. So when you go around the loop, you need to figure out, okay, so in this inductor, the built-in EMF is going to be in such a way that this point is going to be higher potential compared to this one. Okay, so we're going to write VBC as L DIDT. And then, so you have AB and then BC, and then, so you go back from C to A, and you see that. So VC minus VA is negative, since you have the negative terminal on that side and the positive terminal on the A side. So if you write all the terms on the left-hand side of the equation, you're going to have RI plus L DIDT minus V naught equals zero. Okay? So that's a differential equation, first order differential equation with constant coefficients, same type of equation that we got with the RC circuit with the resistor and capacitor. And so the solution is the same. Basically, the idea is that, or at least, let's put that differently, the mathematical form of the solution is the same. So you can look in your textbook for a more thorough proof, page 791. And finally, you get to a solution which varies exponentially, as you expected, as a function of time, because it's exactly the same type of equation. And so you have something that varies like I naught factor of 1 minus exponential negative t over tau. So for t equals 0, exponential is 1, so initial current equals 0. For t equals infinity, the exponential drops to 0, and therefore your final current is going to be I naught, and I naught is actually V naught over R. And RT over L. So the time constant I mentioned earlier is L over R. So that's the analog of RC that we got earlier in electricity for an RC circuit. So that's the time scale that's going to guide you to decide whether you're close to, when you open the switch, close to t equals 0 or close to infinity. So again, you can figure out two regimes. Either you're very close to t equals 0 or you're very close to infinity, and the inductor is going to behave differently. So from this, you can get a plot which shows you that the current increases exponentially, and you asymptotically get to the maximum value here, I naught equals V naught over R. And so you can get from this that at infinite time, it's as if you were to remove the inductor from the circuit. You only have the battery and the resistor in the circuit, and the inductor is not doing anything. Okay. Okay, so we'll continue LR circuit on Thursday, and then we'll talk a little bit about LC circuits, AC currents, and Maxwell equations at the very end.